While it's not rocket science, it's not easy to research our property markets, given the array of jargon and information and the many mixed messages that are out there. So in today's podcast, I'd like to chat with you about some of the many sources of research data that we look into to ensure that we make good investment decisions for ourselves and for our clients at Metropole. Now, if you're a regular listener to this podcast, you know I usually have a guest on each show, but every now and then I'd like to just have a chat with you personally to ensure I get my message across. Now, I recorded a very detailed podcast with my business partner, Kate Forbes, a few months ago where we delved into research, and you can look back at the Michael Yardney podcast to find out about research, but today I'm going to discuss some other aspects of how my team and I at Metropole research properties, and this information will be helpful for you whether you're a beginning investor or an experienced investor. You'll hear me explain the importance of data, but how even more important is the ability to put that plethora of information that we get out there into perspective. And I'm going to share with you a number of metrics that we look at when deciding where to invest. But just as importantly, I'm going to share with you one very commonly used data metric that most property investors use, but at Metropole, something that we almost totally ignore. And I'm going to explain to you why you should also. So welcome to today's show.
Welcome to the Michael Yardney Podcast, where twice each week you will learn a number of new ideas regarding success, property investment, and money in around 30 minutes. Our show is brought to you by Metropole, who specialize in helping you grow, protect, and pass on your wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. Now, here's your host, Michael Yardney, Australia's authority in wealth creation through property, who has been voted one of Australia's top 50 most influential thought leaders.
If you've been following my podcast, you've often heard me say that not all properties are investment grade. So how do you assess a property's investment potential? Now, the topic for the conversation I want to have with you today came from a query from a journalist who asked me, Michael, what numbers do you use to help decide whether to invest in a particular property or not? Of course, I explained to her that before looking at a particular property, which of course is how most investors start, there's a lot more work to be done. I explained that searching for a property is not the same as researching. So let's assume that you've started by building a documented strategic property plan that includes a finance plan and an ownership and asset protection plan. Then the next thing to understand is what your budget is, and then you've got to find the right location where you can find an appropriate property to fit your budget. Now, recognising that location is going to deliver, I don't know, about 80% or so of your property's capital growth, at Metropole we use a top-down approach to ensure we only invest in investment-grade locations, ones that are going to outperform the market averages. So we start with the big picture. How's the economy going, and which state's going to perform strongly during the current property cycle? That's because we recognise that economic growth is going to lead to wages growth, which will lead to new population growth. And these people coming are going to require accommodation, often initially as tenants, but then they're going to buy properties. I explained to the journalist that we only invest in the three big capital cities because that's where the bulk of the economic growth is going to occur in the future. There's no doubt it's going to occur all over Australia, but why fight the big trends? And then we research and we dig down to the right suburbs within those capital cities. Melbourne and Sydney are two big international cities, and Brisbane, which is a New World city. Now, if you don't understand what that means, a New World city, go back to the podcast I did with Brett Warren not that long ago, where we discussed why Brisbane is going to be a very strongly performing market this year. But within those cities, depending upon people's budgets, we look for suburbs that are likely to have the strongest future capital growth potential. These are generally the more affluent suburbs. That's where residents can afford to pay more, as well as gentrifying suburbs where wealthier people are moving into the suburb and improving it. But of course, we don't just invest anywhere in the suburb, and I'm going to explain a bit more about the due diligence we do in a moment. Now, before I get onto the numbers and figures, which I guess is the main thing I want to talk with you about today, I also want to just remind you about the importance of neighbourhood. And if you've been listening to my podcast, I know there's lots of new people joining us every week. That's part of the reason I've got to repeat some of these things. But if you've heard me before, you know the importance of neighbourhood, and it's even more important today post-COVID with a desire for living in a 20-minute neighbourhood, a neighbourhood where you've got a range of amenities, convenience and lifestyle all within a short 20-minute ride, walk or drive away. That's one of the criteria more and more people are looking for. And that's a criteria where affluent people can afford to and are prepared to pay to live in. Now, if you think about it, once this property boom ends and the impetus of low interest rates has worked its way through the system, we're going to end up at a time when affordability will be stretched for many people. And that's because wages won't have risen anywhere near as much as property prices will have increased. At that stage, interest rates are going to have crept up a little bit, and property values, as I said, are going to be significantly higher than they are today. And well-located properties are going to become unaffordable for many. Now, how long is all this going to last? Well, it's not a fixed period of time. And yes, we're really booming along in our property markets at the moment, but all indications are that this current property cycle is going to see an increase overall of about 25 to 30% in property values. And that's based on the research we've done on how much extra affordability people have got with the slight rise in wages. The wages are creeping up a little bit, but also with the affordability because of lower interest rates. But once we work through this and the cycle's over, it means that the divides between the haves and have-nots is only going to increase. Those with multiple streams of income, people with skill level 1 and 2 jobs, which, by the way, I've discussed recently with Simon Kirstenmacher in a previous podcast, you know, skill level 1 and 2 people, ones with higher paying jobs. Now, again, this is not a judge of people, but we have to look at demographics and people's ability to be able to afford to buy property, but also the ability to afford to rent. We don't want tenants who are only a week or two away from broken spending too high a percentage of the income on rent. But the point I'm starting to make is the people with skill levels 1 and 2 jobs, as classed by the Australian Bureau of Statistics, the higher paying jobs, are going to have a greater ability to borrow, to pay more for their homes. And these people will choose and will be able to afford to live in those desirable 20-minute neighbourhoods I mentioned. But the average Australian, the middle-class Australian, they're going to have more difficulty paying for their mortgages, and the properties that they can afford are not going to increase in value as much as the more affluent suburbs because the ability to pay more or pay more rent isn't going to be there. So back to the original question that I was asked, what research can you use? I guess you asked, what research do we use to assess a property's investment potential? Now, to make it clear, what I'm about to share with you isn't directly related to a specific property. At Metropole, we've got very strict criteria to ensure we buy the right property, but let's start with some of the more detailed area location research that we look at. Now, if you've been following these podcasts or my blogs, you probably know by now that I believe property investment is part science and part art. That component is the market intelligence that comes from decades of experience of buying and investing, on the ground experience. And this is crucial because relying solely on the scientific part of the art and science bit, the scientific approach, the data, it's not enough. Statistics won't allow you to differentiate between a good floor plan and a poor layout, a desirable location or neighbourhood compared to a less desirable one. It's something with negative stigma. Or it won't give you concepts like the abundance of natural light or poor orientation. In a lot of areas, we prefer northern orientation just because of the light and the aspect and the warmth. You get the idea? So when it comes down to numbers, the scientific component, I see many investors get swamped by a seemingly endless set of numbers that can potentially paralyze them into inaction. In reality, you don't need to know a million things. You just need to understand a few critical metrics, which I want to share with you now. Now, this list isn't exhaustive. There are quite a lot of metrics that the team at Metropole use to assess an investment's potential or a property's potential to be a good investment. And we spend a lot of time, money and effort and research, and our research department does a lot of work on that. But some of the numbers that we look for are the past sales history. We look at the past capital growth of a particular property or a location to give us indications of future growth potential. Now, you probably know that one of the rules of Metropole's six-stranded strategic approach is to buy in an area that's had a long history of strong capital growth and one that's going to continue to outperform the averages. And I've been through this a minute ago about this. It's got to do with the demographics. Once we've confirmed the quality of the location, we need to drill deeper into the property itself. So first of all, has the location got a strong history of capital growth? And then what about that property? The best way to gauge its potential capital growth is to backtrack its past performance by getting a history of, well, if possible, two previous sales. The trouble is, if you're buying new properties off the plan properties, you just don't have that back history, do you? Now, while past performance is obviously not a guarantee of future performance, fundamentals rarely change. Now, clearly context is important, which is why you've got to compare a particular property's performance against similar properties in the suburb. What I'm getting at is a 7% annual growth rate isn't impressive if the suburb's average for similar types of properties has been 8% over the past 20 years. Now, occasionally you're going to stumble on a property with no prior sales history, as it's been owned by the original owner for a long period of time. Now, of course, this doesn't mean you should discount it from your consideration, but that's where a seasoned buyer's agent with intimate local knowledge can be worth their weight in gold. They'd instinctively know what the valid comparables are. Again, that's the art part of the science versus art in property investing. So past performance is one of those comparables that can be calculated, which can be used to impute the performance of the property that you're looking at. Another metric that we look at is days on market, and that's a measure of how long it's taking to sell a typical property in a particular suburb. And more important than the actual number is the trend, and that provides some context to what's happening in the market at the moment. Clearly, when demand's high and there are more buyers than properties available, the days on market will decrease. On the other hand, when the market's soft because of economic conditions, or perhaps because there's a flood of new properties coming available, then the time on market's going to increase. And that sometimes drives down property values, or it stops them rising as fast. So this is one statistic that can help investors identify those locations that are strengthening if the trend's in the right direction, so they can get in before the masses and therefore make the most of the price uplift at a time that it suits them. Now, again, I'm not suggesting buy what works now. I'm always talking about buying the sort of property that's worked in the long term. So I'm not looking for the next hot spot, but basically I'd be, one of the things we look at and understand the dynamics of a market is what's happening today's on market. The other dynamic we look at is actually depth on market. What we're looking for here is an assessment of the supply versus demand balance within a particular market. This is a measure of how long it would take for the current inventory, the number of properties on the market, to be purchased based on the current rate of monthly sales, assuming there's no more inventory coming onto the market. So the depth of the market gives you an indication of how many people are looking, and if there's minimal market depth, there's going to be more volatility. So a market's considered balanced if it's got between somewhere between 5 and 7 months worth of inventory, properties for sale. So if hypothetically all the properties available for sale in a market are sold in less than 5 months, it implies great market depth. Lots of buyers waiting in line with an inventory turnover of 8 months or more. It implies an oversupplied market with less depth of buyers. I mean, look at the Melbourne CBD apartment market for a moment. I mean, that's currently been very adversely affected by COVID-19, hasn't it? When you look back a couple of years ago, a year ago, it was sat at 8.47 months of supply, meaning there was already a position of oversupply. But fast forward to today, and it's estimated that on current sales levels, it would take over 16 months to sell all the properties on the market in the Melbourne CBD if no new ones came onto the market. In other words, there's little market depth, no long queue of buyers waiting to absorb the market inventory. Now, we're seeing the same trend happening in some of the outer suburbs, predominantly made up of new home and land packages, where now that the big incentive has gone with the home builder and the stamp duty discounts and demand from a lot of first homeowners has been brought forward, that you'll actually find that there's not as much market depth in those outer areas. So my point is avoid the outer suburban house and land packages and the inner CBD apartment markets. Now, another metric we look at, another figure we look at, is the ratio of owner-occupiers to renters. While many beginning investors have their prospective tenants top of mind, an important strand of Metropole six-stranded strategic approach is to only buy properties with owner-occupier appeal. Since owner-occupiers account for 70% of the properties, they make the market. They add stability to property values in those suburbs where there's a predominance of established owner-occupiers, and ones who bought their home many, many years ago because they've got significant equity in their properties. Now, this is very different to the instability and the volatility we see in house prices in areas dominated by investors, think the inner city apartment markets, or the outer suburbs where there's little scarcity and many first home buyers have overcommitted and have little equity in their home. I found owner-occupiers buy with their hearts and not their calculators, and they tend to happily pay an emotional premium if there's something unique about the property they fall in love with. By the way, that's another strand of Metropole six-stranded approach. Buy a property with a twist, something unique, something special, something different about it. But it goes without saying, like all these other metrics I'm talking about now, this shouldn't be looked at in isolation. It's just one layer on top of the other, adding to your knowledge to give you the right context. So certain suburbs will always have a higher proportion of renters. Think like Bondi Beach or Potts Point in Sydney or Elwood in Melbourne. Yet the right properties in certain pockets of these suburbs still make great investments. Another metric we look at when doing suburb research is we're looking for areas with above average wages growth. Since property investment's a game of finance, with some houses thrown in the middle, it's important to find a location where the local residents have high disposable income. Now, I mentioned that a little bit earlier on, didn't I? But these are locations where people will be able to afford and be prepared to pay more to buy their new home, to upgrade their home. And as I said before, these are often suburbs going through gentrification, where a change in fortune of the suburb happens as it's discovered by higher income demographic, and it slowly pushes out some of the lower income residents. Think of Balmain or Redfern in Sydney, Elwood or Fitzroy in Melbourne, Tenerife or in Brisbane, Braddon in Canberra. Now, another of the metrics we look at are auction clearance rates. Now, these are a great in-time indicator of market sentiment. One of the reasons every week Dr. Andrew Wilson and I in our Property Insider videos discuss what's happening in the market. But it's not enough. Firstly, auction clearance rates are most relevant in Sydney or Melbourne, where a significant portion of all the sales that occur in that state are auction-related. But you've got to look further. You can't look at the whole city's auction clearance rates. And that's why I like using Dr. Andrew Wilson's figures, and I report them every week in Property Update, where we actually break it down, or Dr. Wilson breaks it down, to suburbs, to locations, to regions, because some regions have stronger, higher auction clearance rates than others. And of course, he also breaks it down to houses and apartments, and that's important to understand. So you get an idea of what's happening to the region that you're looking at. But now I want to share with you one statistic that most investors use that we don't use at Metropole. We don't rely on median prices, but most beginners use median prices as their guide for suburb selection. So I think it's really important to be careful observing median prices, as they're not really as useful as you probably think. They're one of the most cited statistics after probably auction clearance rates, but there are some huge shortcomings that you as an investor need to understand in order not to be misled with what's happening to house price values. Let me share five things with you about median prices that I believe you need to understand. Firstly, how are they calculated? Well, the median house price is essentially the sale price of the middle home in a list of sales that ranged from highest to lowest. Now, to make it simple, if there are 11 sales that occurred in a suburb, it would be the house price of the house number six, which has five prices sales below it and five higher price sales above it. Now, this is different to the average, which would be the total of all the house sales divided by the number of homes that actually sold. Technically speaking, the median is more accurate than the average because it's less affected by that very high, unusually high or low sale. So median prices in property are based on the homes that have recently transacted over a period of time, and most often they're divided into units, apartment, median prices and house prices. But let me make it clear, a change in the median price doesn't necessarily mean a change in your property's value or the value of a particular property you're looking at. While they may be a useful tool to understanding changes that have happened in properties that have transacted, a 10% increase doesn't mean that your property's gone up 10%. In fact, it could have dropped during that time. So it reflects what has sold on the market. So if there has been, during COVID last year, higher end properties didn't sell much, people just didn't need to sell if they were more affluent, the median price has dropped and indicated maybe a lower value than they should have because it was the cheaper properties that were selling. But it didn't mean the high end properties dropped in value much. I guess the point I'd like to make is that median prices are more valuable in some areas than others. They're more meaningful in suburbs where the houses are largely homogenous, much the same, and therefore similar pricing and are likely to see median prices a more accurate reflection of the true changes. And also, suburbs where many properties transact on a regular basis will be more statistically meaningful than areas where homes are more tightly held, sell infrequently, and are significantly different to others, not homogenous, not all the same. Similarly, some suburbs are just far too large for a median number to be meaningful. They've got good and bad locations on different sides of main road or close to main roads, and those different locations in the same big suburb don't perform as well, but they're lumped together when you look at median prices of a suburb. Likewise, relying on median price changes at a capital city level, which is so commonly reported, that's too broad, it's misleading, it's useless. But you're going to hear in the media all the time, Melbourne's median price went up 7% or 8% or whatever it is. Now, medians are also misleading when a suburb has got two distinct markets. Now, this is common in Bayside suburbs where there are houses near the beach and they fall in one price range and they're very different to houses further inland. So median prices can also be misleading in some of those newer outer suburbs where the type of property sold a number of years ago, for example, vacant land, has now been replaced by new homes. And of course, gentrification, with locals renovating their properties, can change the nature and the quality of properties and therefore the median price. So in some areas, median prices are more useful than others. But the other problem is, what is the median price? Because when you look in the media, you're going to find different data providers measure different statistics. Have you wondered why different providers provide different median prices? How can they be so different? Well, that's because they look at different things. You've got to look at the data they collect, the time frames, daily, monthly, quarterly, and the accuracy or complexity of the model, the methodology they rely on. So one way around the shortfall of median property value changes is to use data sets like CoreLogic's Hedonic Index, which seeks to overcome some of the issues that I've been mentioning by measuring attributes of a property that are transacting. They try and work out what's happened to that property because of their deep data knowledge as part of the analysis of median price. So understanding factors such as the number of bedrooms, the number of bathrooms, the land area, the geographic context of the property allows for more accurate analysis of the true value than just broad brushed median prices. So CoreLogic provides a hedonic index. But I think, like most data sets, an important message to remember is statistics are more reliable if looked over the long term. So despite the downfall in median prices, if you look over it in the long term, you're probably going to get a better understanding. So I started by mentioning to you that I was asked, what numbers, what data do we look at? And I hope the message you're getting from me is relying on data too heavily can cause problem. I mean, as I said, property investment's part art and science, and you've got to mix the knowledge of local markets together with the data, because statistics alone won't allow you to differentiate between a good floor plan and a poor one, a desirable neighbourhood. I'm not suggesting you shouldn't understand the fundamentals. It's important to research the data, and the longer back the data research goes, the more accurate it's going to be. But if you don't have access to all this data, then rely on somebody like my team at Metropole to help you, because first of all, you've got to have the data, but then you've got to interpret it correctly, and that's why we have a research department. Let's be frank, you can make the data say almost anything you want. I've seen too many property investors find a property they like, one that they've become emotionally attached to, and then they find the data to confirm their decision. This, of course, is called confirmation bias. They're using data backwards rather than the right way. What I'm getting at is that while you need the data in your research phase of your investment journey to be a successful property investor, you need much more than that. I keep saying it, on-the-ground experience perspective. Data is only going to get you part of the way. You must complement the data with local area knowledge. Now, if you're an expert in your area, fantastic. But if not, that's why our buyer's agents at Metropole, who are excelling agents, can help you interpret the data. They understand the local market drivers. They understand why one side of the road is more valuable than the other, or why one part of a suburb is more in demand than another. And this is the type of perspective that money can't buy. Property investors who only do their research on the internet, but don't have the on-the-ground experience or the context. They've got the science part of the investment equation covered, but they miss out on the art part of the investment smarts. Now, don't get me wrong, doing the research is an important step, but it's only one of the important steps. There's no substitute for on-the-ground experience. So if you're wanting to take advantage of the opportunities the current property markets are offering, considering that they're slowing down a little bit and you've got to be careful and you've got to finish up with the right sort of property that's going to suit you over the long term, not just now, why not get a holistic approach from my team at Metropole? We'll give you direction, guidance and results. Just go to metropole.com.au and find out how we always start by putting together a strategic property plan for you. We bring your future into the present so you can do something about it. And then if you choose to, you can use our buyer's agents, our wealth advisory, our property management services. We'd love to be part of your wealth creation journey. So go to metropole.com.au and find out all about what we do. I'd love to be part of your wealth creation journey.
Now here's Michael's mindset message. Remember, a change in your thinking will lead to a change in your life.
In today's mindset message, I'd like to remind you that laughter is the best medicine. It's fun to share a good laugh, but did you know it can actually improve your health? Look, life keeps throwing stresses at us. Life is difficult in your personal life, in your business life as an investor. So I think it's worth remembering that many studies show that laughter has a number of health benefits. It's not just fun while you do it. For example, laughter relaxes the whole body. A good hearty laugh relieves physical tension, relieves stress, leaves your muscles relaxed, interestingly, for up to 45 minutes afterwards. Laughter also boosts the immune system. Laughter tends to decrease stress hormones and increases immune cells and infection-fighting antibodies. Therefore, it actually helps increase resistance to disease. Scientific studies show that laughter triggers the release of endorphins. You know, they're the body's natural feel-good hormones. Endorphins promote an overall sense of well-being and even give a temporary relief of pain. Apparently, laughter protects your heart. It improves blood function and increases blood flow to the heart. Laughter also burns calories. Okay, it's no replacement for going to the gym, but one study I read found that laughing for 10 to 15 minutes a day can burn approximately 40 calories. So maybe you could eat another chocolate in the meantime. Hey, that makes me feel good too. Laughter lightens anger's heavy load. Nothing diffuses anger or conflict like a shared laugh. So look for the funny side in things. It sometimes puts the problems in your life into perspective and enables you to move on from confrontation without holding on to bitterness or resentment. And the good news is one study in Norway found that laughter can even help you live longer. People with a strong sense of humour outlive those who didn't laugh as much. And was particularly important in people who are battling cancer. So when life isn't cooperating or your day's not going well, find something that will make you good laugh, make you laugh. I know you may have to look for it, but laughter will make you feel good. And this positive feeling is going to remain with you long after the laughter's gone. Humour helps you keep a positive and optimistic outlook through those difficult situations, through the disappointments, through the losses. You see, laughter is an emotional reset button. It immediately clears away the stress, the negativity brought by these bad days, and it awakens the executive decision-making part of your brain. It helps you think clearly. Now, the ability to laugh, play, and have fun not only makes life more enjoyable, but it does actually help you solve problems. It helps you connect with others. It helps you think more creatively. It's been found that people who incorporate humour and play in their daily lives find it renews them It also helps their relationships. So life is going to keep bringing you challenges. We can't stop that. But you can make the best of it by looking for something interesting, something fun, a plaything with your imagination. Think outside the box. Find new solutions. If you think about it, as children, we used to laugh 100 times a day. But as adults, I don't know, life tends to make things more serious and we tend to laugh less frequently. But by seeking out opportunities, look for reasons to laugh, look for humour. You can improve your emotional health. It can strengthen your relationships. It can find greatness in things that you didn't look too good. You're going to find happiness. And, as I said, it could increase years in your life. So my mindset message today is laughter is the best medicine. I hope you got some clarity from today's show, but if you're looking for more information about property and research and finance, I've got a bundle of ebooks to gift to you as a way of saying thank you for listening to my podcast. Just go to podcastbonus.com.au, leave us your details, and I'll give you a copy of some ebooks and reports. Now, if you enjoyed today's show, if you got some benefit from today's show, help me in my quest to make more Australians financially literate and better property investors. Tell somebody about the Michael Yardley podcast, or of course you can leave a review for us. We love those as well. I'll be back again real soon, but you can catch me in between these regular podcasts on social media. Just look for Michael Yardley, or you can join my private Facebook group where every day I leave a snippet of information, a chart, a graph, something a little bit different that I don't leave elsewhere to help you make more sensible property investment decisions. Just go to Facebook and look for the private Facebook group, the Property Update private Facebook group, and I'd love to share my ideas with you. I'll be back again real soon. In the meantime, have a great week. Make it a great week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Michael Yardney podcast, which was brought to you by Metropole, who help their clients grow, protect, and pass on their wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. If you like what you heard and don't already subscribe, you'll find us on iTunes or on your favorite Android app as the Michael Yardney podcast. Watch out for our next show, which comes to you twice a week, and you'll learn some new ideas about property investment, success, and money in around 30 minutes. To get more of Michael's thoughts, go across to www.propertyupdate.com.au and sign up for his daily morning briefing, and you'll hear from not only Michael, but a group of leading property success and money experts. And just a reminder that the information you heard in this show today is general educational advice and not specific investment advice, as we don't know your personal circumstances. If you're looking for specific advice, why not ask the team at Metropole to help you?